We'll call this a meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. The hour of 10:15 having arrived, February 1st, 2011. We'll have a few announcements to make once we have a quorum, and we'll officially call the meeting to order. We're honored today to have Mr. Scott Hodge, President of the Tax Foundation, to make a presentation regarding making Minnesota entitled Creating a More Competitive Tax Climate for Minnesota. We'll be very interested to see what Mr. Hodge has to say today. Do we have a quorum? Okay, Mr. Hodge, welcome to the committee. As soon as we have a quorum, I'll be interrupting and going through a few procedural items, but we're very happy to have you here today. If you could please start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about improving Minnesota's tax climate and economy, not only in the short term, but for the long term.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hodge, if you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Excuse me, I'm Scott Hodge, president of the Tax Foundation. The Tax Foundation is a Washington-based think tank. We have been around since 1937. Our principal mission is to be the foremost authorities on economically sound tax policy, not only in Washington, but in state capitals across the nation. And we advocate some very simple principles of sound economic tax policy. First of all, taxes should be neutral. They should be neutral to economic decision-making, both for individuals
and for businesses. Mr. Hodge, for the second interruption, I'm sorry. Sure. We do now have a quorum. We'll get a few items out of the way here, and then I'll probably only interrupt about six more times.
Okay,
so
fine.
We'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Depke moves the minutes of January 27th. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, if you just look in your packets for a moment here, we've included the Tax Committee accounts for the 2011-12 session. You might want to just keep those in your folder so you can refer to them. If you say, well, do we really do that, then you can just look and say either yes, we do, or no, we don't. And then I will be referring the bills to the Property and Local Tax Division, House File 181, Scott, House File 195, Scalzi, three Davids bills, House File 234, 274, 275, all fine pieces of legislation, I'm sure. And then two more from Lincheski, House File 289 and House File 290. We're moving over to the Property Tax, Property and Local Tax Division. So with that, I think that's it. Mr. Hodge, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as you know, I struggled to get here last night, so I hope I can make it worth everyone's while. We are talking about improving Minnesota's tax climate, principally by either eliminating or certainly phasing out the corporate income tax. I think a welcome topic, given the fact that this is also getting considerable attention in Washington about the U.S. federal rate. But the bottom line is that when it comes to tax policy, Minnesota is not a very attractive place. And quite simply, Minnesota has consistently had one of the highest overall tax burdens in the nation when you combine state and local taxes. And according to the Tax Foundation's Business Tax Climate Index, Minnesota has one of the worst tax climates for business among in the nation. And when it comes to corporate taxes, as we'll see in greater detail, the corporate income tax is near one of the near the top. It's one of the highest in the nation. In short, put in kind of simple layman's terms, Minnesota has a Neiman Marcus corporate income tax system in a day and age in which you need Walmart-type tax system. You have everyday high taxes every day, and you try to mitigate the damage, the economic damage from that those high taxes through a variety of things, such as economic development incentives, a single sales factor, and so forth. But the real crux here is that you need to start moving toward having everyday low taxes every day and allow the marketplace to come to you because you have the best value for the dollar. And as we'll see here in a second, out-migration has been a problem for Minnesota, which is shrinking not only your population but your tax base as well. And so one thing I will recommend as we move along is perhaps considering what I call the Utah-Colorado model, and that is lowering both your corporate and individual rates down to a low flat level. So you're basically treating corporations and non-corporate businesses in the same fashion. But let's look first at the migration issue here, which ought to be of great concern because this is not only represents the health of the state, but also your tax base. And while people move for a whole variety of reasons, weather, God knows why anyone would move to Minnesota. Actually, I lived here for a year, so I shouldn't say. People retire, businesses move, and so forth. But there, while there are a lot of factors in this, taxes are certainly one of them. And we have to take that into consideration. Tax Foundation economists have gotten some IRS data which looks at migration patterns of taxpayers across the 50 states. And we can look at basically the influx of taxpayers into a state and then the outflux or the outmigration of taxpayers to other states and then look at the difference, not only in terms of the number of taxpayers, but also their adjusted gross income. What this slide does is show you that balance. The top line representing the number of taxpayers who move from Minnesota to other states. That's the red bar at the red line at the top. And then the blue one is the number of taxpayers who move into the state. And as you can see, there's a difference. There's, in fact, a $3,000 or 3,000 person or taxpayer difference per year. There are about 43,000 taxpayers who move into the state, but 46,000 on average each year who move out of the state. The difference, the bottom line, or the true bottom line here in this slide, means the net loss of about 3,000 taxpayers to other states each and every year between the years 2000 and 2008.
Mr. Hodge, we have some questions. Would you like to take them as you go, or would
Sure.
you like to make your presentation and then we do the questions, or what would you prefer?
If you want to jump in, please, especially if there are particular questions on the...
As we go per slide. Okay.
On the data.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hodge, on this particular slide, help us understand it more. I'm curious how people who don't pay taxes relates to these curves that you have here.
These won't show up. This is only tax... It's tax returns as defined by the IRS. So they're looking at a tax return that was filed in Minnesota. It's a federal return versus where that return was filed the following year. And so if it ended up being Wisconsin, then it would show the difference, and vice versa. Now, these are looking at just tax returns. There's also, we have information on our website about all the dependents who are filed on those taxes, so you can see the total number of people as well. So this is just the tax return itself.
Perfect.
And so non-payers would not appear on this, and that's why it's possible that Minnesota may actually see an increase in population because you have people coming here to go to school, and that may inflate the population number, but if they leave, they wouldn't show up on this if they're not a taxpayer.
You Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this kind of falls along the line of Representative Draskowski's question, but is there anything else you can tell us about the people who are leaving Minnesota? And we probably all get anecdotal comments from constituents on that about people either once they reach a certain age or their kids are grown and that start to look at warmer climes and perhaps sunnier tax climates, if
sure.
you will, for them. But any other data to help fill in some of the information with regards to tax brackets for these people who are leaving, or their ages, or whether they own businesses, or
sadly the IRS data is very sterile when it comes to demographic information, so we don't have that. And I'd have to dig into some of the census data to find out where who those people are that are leaving, whether they're just seniors who have decided they're tired of shoveling snow, or whether you have a more serious problem where you're looking at people at the prime of their working age who are finally moving to friendlier climates. I just don't know. The IRS data sadly is very sterile when it comes to that sort of information. But what you do see in the next slide is the income that is leaving the state, because not only do people leave, but they take their incomes with them. And the basic message here is very similar, in that you've seen some influx of people and their income moving into the state, the outflow or outmigration adds up. And over this 8-year period of time, the state lost $2.8 billion in adjusted gross income to other states on net as people moved out. This is not as serious, I guess to put a happy face on it, not as serious as other states such as Michigan, who are just about to turn out the lights there. But it's something that ought to be of concern, because this is a trend that can impact the state finances. This is basically your tax base that's leaving the state. And so while this is, you know, your loss, it's other states' gain. And as I like to say, if these kinds of trends are left unchecked, a state can get into sort of a fiscal death spiral, that as people flee the state, you have to raise taxes on those who have not left in order to raise the same amount of money. You then create a hostile climate, and those people vote with their feet and move to other states. You have to continue the cycle, and then very soon you look like Greece or California. And so this is something that you obviously want to avoid.
Okay, Representative Loon. Okay, before we continue here, we have the 9th and 10th grade students from the Great River School in St. Paul. Who is your state legislator? Oh, all over.
All over.
So the St. Paul delegation welcomes you. And the rest of us. Well, welcome to the Tax Committee. Okay, let's proceed, please, Mr. Hodge.
Thank
you. Excuse me, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hodge, I just wondered if you've looked at data related to property tax burdens and how much of this is border state issues as opposed to moving to other regions of the country.
I'd have to dig a little deeper into that. We do have property tax data, and if you were to go to the Tax Foundation website, you can look up we have a calculator or a lookup tool where you can go and see property tax or counties ranked in terms of their property tax burdens. I don't happen to have that in front of me, and I don't know how Minnesota ranks per se. That most heavily property tax states tend to be the New Yorks, New Jerseys, and Connecticuts. But I don't know how that plays into this as opposed to corporate or individual taxes. That would take a little more digging.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, the other question I had was about border state issues, since we have, you know, Superior and Duluth and Moorhead and Fargo and, you know, a lot of people living just across the border in Wisconsin who work in the Twin Cities. I mean, is that an influence more in Minnesota probably than some other states?
Mr. Hodge?
Well, I would assume that it is. We see this all across the country where we have great differentials in taxes between states. New Hampshire and Minnesota, or excuse me, and Massachusetts is a prime example, where about 17% of the people that work in Massachusetts live in New Hampshire. So New Hampshire does not have a personal income tax, and of course Massachusetts is known for its taxes. And you see similar things between Oregon and Washington State. Oregon has no sales tax. Washington State has a high sales tax. People shop in Oregon who live in Washington State. On the other hand, Washington State doesn't have a personal income tax, so you have a lot of people that do the reverse commute. They shop in one state and live in another. And so forth. Taxes matter, and cross-border issues are a very serious concern where you have great differentials between those borders.
Representative Loeffler?
That's fine, thank you.
Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hodge, you mentioned on the previous slide, it didn't, slide number four anyway, that it didn't consider people who didn't pay taxes. We are here in Minnesota. It's been maintained and suggested that we're a welfare magnet, if you will. We've got a very generous welfare system. How might that contribute to this particular slide number five, actually, which is the one previous to this, or maybe it doesn't as well? similar to the other one.
Mr. Hodge?
Well, those individuals would not show up on this if they are not filing tax returns. And so they're, I wouldn't say sneaking under the radar, but they are off the grid, if you will, as not part of the income tax system. We would see them in census data. Census data will capture individuals who don't pay income taxes. So we would have to look at that that kind of data to see. But, you know, if they're not paying income taxes, we wouldn't see them on this. And so we wouldn't necessarily see the influx or the migration of them.
Representative Drazkowski? Please continue, Mr. Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far back as the Tax Foundation has data on state taxes, Minnesota has been one of the highest tax burden states in the nation. In fact, for about 40 consecutive years, Minnesota ranked in the top 10 in terms of its combined state and local tax burden, well above the national average, as you can see in this particular chart. And while that differential has been shrinking within the last couple of years, and actually Minnesota moved out of the top 10 and into the 12th position, the state still looks and resembles more the high-tax states such as a New Jersey or a New York than it does a low-tax state such as Florida or Nevada. And so this has been a continuing trend. And I somewhat jokingly in my written testimony say that I know some people blame the citizens' acceptance of higher taxes based on their sort of Northern European origins, but I should say that Sweden has recently cut its corporate and personal income taxes, so you no longer have to carry the legacy of Northern European tax burden. So I guess if it's good enough for Sweden, it's good enough for Minnesota as well. Now, there are two ways in which we can assess the state's overall tax system. One is the burden, which I just talked about. The other, it's important to look at how a state taxes, meaning the structure of a state's tax system. And with that, the Tax Foundation uses its annual State Business Tax Climate Index. And the Business Climate Index measures the business friendliness of each state's tax system based on more than 100 different variables. And we assess the five major areas within a state's tax system. Obviously, your corporate income tax, personal income tax, your sales tax system, your sort of property and wealth tax, and then the unemployment tax system. Each one of those areas is assessed individually, and then it tiers up into a national ranking. And the guiding principle, getting back to my first slide, the guiding principle of this particular index is tax neutrality. And that is taxes should play as little part in economic decision making for individuals and businesses as possible. And so this index actually rewards states that don't have a major tax, because that's about as neutral as you can get. And it also rewards states that have sort of a low rate, broad-based, flat systems. On the contrary, the index punishes states that have high, progressive, and complex systems, because those are the most those are the types of tax systems that distort economic decision making the most. And so, on this map, the light gray or white, I guess they would show up as white colored states, are the 10 best states in our assessment in terms of their tax climates for business. And the dark gray or dark blue states are the 10 worst states for business. And the best being states like Florida, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, Indiana, and New Hampshire, while the worst states include Minnesota. So we're looking at states such as Iowa and California, Ohio, North Carolina, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Maryland.
Excuse me, Representative Lesh.
Oh.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair, for the testifier. Can you tell me, because I was trying to figure out here the population in these states, of the white states, of how many Fortune 500 companies there are in Montana, Wyoming, South Dakota, and Utah?
Mr.
If you can think of any. I couldn't think of any.
Well, this is not a measure of where Fortune 500s are headquartered. This is a measure of a broad-based business climate. And we have to remember that Fortune 500 companies really are not the economy. There's an entire economy that's, in fact, most, as I'll talk about in a minute, later on in my testimony, the majority of companies today are not corporations. They're what's considered pass-through entities, LLCs, partnerships, S-corps, and so forth. And so you, when you're assessing a business climate, you have to go beyond just where a corporate headquarter would be. You have to look at where other businesses would thrive as well, in particular individual type or individually owned businesses. But to your point, Texas now has more corporate headquarters than New York, and more fleeing those states every day. But a corporate headquarters does not mean where the corporation is investing. Intel may be headquartered in California, but Intel will never build another wafer fabrication plant in California, ever, as long as they have the tax system they have. The last one they built in the United States was in New Mexico, and they have another one planned in. Now I can't remember, but anyway, they're building outside of California. PepsiCo is headquartered in New York. They don't have any real bottling plants there. They invest elsewhere. You can plan around where you have your headquarters, and having a few hundred corporate execs is nice. But where you want to really know is where companies are investing. 3M may be headquartered here, but where are they building their plants? Where are they investing in? So this is not a corporate headquarter index. It's a tax climate index.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, and I appreciate that answer, Mr. Hodge. I just my point is to figure out where people actually want to go when it comes down to it. And if you make the point that this chart suggests that people want to go to Wyoming or Montana or Utah or Nevada, that may be the case. I just want to figure out why aren't they getting the people then, or in Alaska. So
I'll freely admit there are a lot of reasons why a company would invest anywhere or locate anywhere. If taxes are a priority, then this index is very useful. If you need high, if you need transportation hubs, or you need a deep water port, taxes may be second on your list. If you need to put a call center for a financial center, South Dakota may be at the top of your list. So there are various factors that go into where businesses decide to locate, and if taxes are one of them, this can be a very helpful guide.
Representative Lesh? Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, maybe a really generalized question for the testifier. So clearly you're not the business climate presentation that you're making here is very specifically focused on the tax component of an overall business climate. And do you have any advice for us as we're sitting here listening to your presentation about how to kind of consider the tax component of an overall business climate with regard to everything else, which I think gets to Representative Lesh's point, and it's a legitimate one. And maybe a more specific sub-question of that is, in your experience or the way you look at data, are businesses and people more sensitive to tax policy today than they were previously? Is there kind of a trend that says this should be an increasingly important focus for us here in Minnesota?
Mr. Hodge?
The answer to that is a clear yes. Taxes are more important today than they perhaps ever have been. And that's because capital is more mobile today than it ever has been, and that's investment dollars, and thus most sensitive to higher taxes. And I'll go into a little more detail on that in some later slides. And as a part of that, people are not very mobile, not in the same way that capital is. And so while my employer may take advantage of Ireland's 12.5% corporate tax rate and move a factory there, I can't very well pick up my family and move to Dublin to follow that job. And so taxes are an increasing part of business decision-making, especially on a global basis. And I think it's very critical that states, and we'll get into that, this is the very next slide, take their tax position very seriously, not only how they rank regionally, but nationally, and then now globally, because investment dollars are now global. The economy is now global.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe back to the original question about advice to us as we're listening to your presentation about how to kind of understand tax policy and Minnesota's overall comparative advantage, kind of the value proposition that Minnesota would offer to people and businesses. Any advice to us? I mean, we can look at this and look at the facts kind of within the tax policy dimension, but is there any general guidance from you to us as we're hearing your testimony today about the broader overall map of Minnesota's business climate, or should we just realize we're limited to looking at the tax policy and leave it at that and understand your data from that perspective and try not to infer too much from it?
Mr. Hodge?
Well, you do have to look at these things holistically, but from as we look at the tax situation and we look at Minnesota in particular, Minnesota is very, very much out of step, not only nationally, but also globally. And your tax rates, both on individual and corporate income, are far too high. And as I'll get back to the Neiman Marcus analogy, I think is very apt here, in that you have placed yourself sort of out of the marketplace of states when it comes to tax policy. And I think that the faster that you get in line with where the rest of the market is, the better off you'll be. It's as if Target, for instance, had outpriced a particular product and was losing market share. And that's a similar thing here, where you've sort of you've outpriced yourself from the market, and you're losing market share to other states.
Representative Downey?
I hope I've...
Representative Tilbury?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at your slides here, and I was just wondering, where do tax exemptions fit into it?
Mr. Hodge?
We're not fans of tax exemptions. I think there are... Well, let's separate things. There are clearly areas in which businesses should be able to legitimately deduct items from their taxes. These are legitimate business expenses, cost of goods sold, et cetera. Then there are things in which the legislators have included in the tax system, which are trying to micromanage certain kinds of activities. Those are the kinds of things that we would want taken out of the code and in favor of lower rate. And using the tax code as an economic development tool, we don't think is a legitimate use of the tax system. It creates distortions, it micromanages things, et cetera.
Mr. Tilbury? Chair, one other question, and it kind of distorts some of the rankings then if all that isn't concluded, because some states might have two exemptions, or maybe another state might have 36 exemptions or whatever. So a slide in here that would state how many exemptions states use might be helpful.
Mr. Hodge?
We've thought about that. But our goal here is to rank the core tax system within a state, not how much they've tried to use it to micromanage various kinds of activities. And at a certain point, companies who have been lured into a state or new companies that have taken advantage of various exemptions mature and are no longer eligible for those things. And so what we're trying to do is measure the core tax system within a state, not how much it's using special sales or incentives in order to lure business or attract business. It's like trying to compare retailers, not how much the price of a good was on the Memorial Day sale, but how much it is on a basic everyday price. And that's what we're trying to do.
Representative Tilbury?
One more question. It just seems like you're missing an important piece just because you don't want to include it. is what I'm getting at. And that's all okay. I can understand if you don't want to figure exemptions and you want to go with this particular theory. But because businesses then would pay less because of exemptions, that should have an effect on your slides.
There are two types of exempt. Now, we're not looking at the basic. We're not looking at extraordinary exemptions. In fact, we kind of ding some states for that. If they're using that too frequently, they're undermining their own tax system. And this is not a business tax burden index either. This is not looking at what a bottom line of what a typical type of business would pay in one state versus what it would in another. This is looking at the structure of the tax system. In fact, we're in the process of building a new model to look at what a prototypical business would pay in taxes in each state. In that case, we would look at things like depreciation, an R&E credit, that sort of thing. We wouldn't get into the special exemptions, but we would look at the core things that are legitimate business expenses within a tax structure.
Representative Tilbury?
Other comment. It just seems like you're kind of measuring apples to oranges to pineapples throughout all of the states.
Mr. Hodge?
And I don't mean to do that before lunch.
Well, this slide in particular looks at the list price of every state. And the list price is pretty objective. Now, there are lots of factors that go into what the effective tax rate is, no doubt. Iowa, for instance, deducts, not only can companies deduct state taxes from federal taxes, but they can deduct federal taxes from state taxes. So their effective rate goes down from 12% to 10 or something like that. Pennsylvania has, you know, some other credits and so forth. But it's important also to look at the list price, because in economics today, we're beginning to understand a lot more about the difference between statutory and effective tax rates. And that effective tax rates were kind of an old economy notion. When companies had large write-offs, plant and equipment and all kinds of big purchases. But today, the most dynamic companies, the most dynamic businesses, the ones that contribute most to economic growth are the brain companies, the ones that are driven by intellectual property and patents and those kinds of things. And for them, the statutory rate is effectively the effective rate, because they don't have big equipment write-offs. They don't have lots of other things. And so for them, the list price matters perhaps more than anything. And if you talk to business CEOs and so forth, they look at the list price. You know, they're not in there. You know, it's up to the tax guy to figure out how to use and manipulate the tax code to lower their effective rate. But when they're looking at location, they're looking at the list price, and, you know, and that matters.
Representative Tilbury?
I'm okay with that.
Okay. You don't have to go back one slide, but I just was looking at your top 10 and lower 10 states. Where does Texas fit in there? What number would they be?
There's one out of the top 10 at...
you're supposed to read that.
13th or 13th.
Oh, that's clear. Okay.
Yeah.
13th. Okay, thank you. Representative Lincheski, Loeffler and Bills. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having this presenter here today. It's nice to hear this information. And one thing I found is that migration data is not readily available to decision makers. And when you can find it, it often contradicts the studies you look at contradict each other as far as, you know, who's really leaving and why, and you know, are they going to be with their grandkids, or is it because they can get a tax cut? And so it's very difficult to understand the data and attempting to research it. But you know, I agree that business taxes are regressive, and they are usually paid by workers or higher prices, and generally we should try to get rid of them. And so, you know, watching the nation now, it appears that the trend is to get rid of corporate taxes, and one state after another is trying to do that. You know, in Minnesota, the corporate tax, we have a very narrow base, high rate, very narrow base compared to most states, and we also are pretty far along in single sales apportionment. So those are benefits for us. And so I think that's part of the list price argument. You have to understand what is the corporate tax in Minnesota, but this committee knows that most businesses don't pay the corporate tax in Minnesota. They pay the income tax in Minnesota. So if you're an S-Corp or a partnership or whatever, you're flowing your tax through the income tax system. And so when you were talking earlier about, you know, the individual income tax and the corporate tax and how that makes Minnesota not competitive, you know, I agree with a lot of that. I guess the question for policymakers is, to me, is this. So in Minnesota's tax revenue stream, about a little less than half of all our revenue is in those two taxes. So between the individual income tax, which is about 42%, I think, of our total revenue, and the corporate tax, which isn't very big in Minnesota, it's about a billion, and it's very volatile. In some years, it's nothing, and it, you know, of course, you have to have a liability to pay a tax in the first place. So, in the recent recession, you know, not a lot of businesses have a lot of liability because they're losing money. So, but even in a good year, and actually this year, it's projected to be a good year, about a billion. It's not a big chunk for us in Minnesota. So, you know, as decision makers, you know, we now have a new governor who is not interested in increasing regressive systems, whether it's through cutting or through raising revenue. You know, he's run on, we need to make the full system more progressive, not more regressive. So even in, if everyone could agree, let's cut all these taxes and let's not spend any new money, how would a state throw out half of its revenue stream without converting to a much more regressive system? Because I think that only leaves consumption taxes.
Right.
So, and I know, you know, Minnesota, there's nine states that don't have an income tax. So we could be like them. We could just abolish the income tax. And there's a bunch of states who are doing different things and corporate things. So maybe you can help us think through, as people who, I think a lot of us understand, it is a negative market advantage. And it's 50% of the money between those two taxes. And the majority of the businesses, you know, even if we abolish the corporate tax, which I've tried to do, the chair here has got a bill to do, it's not, you know, 90-some percent of our businesses don't pay that, so it doesn't give them any tax relief at all. So, you know, your thoughts on how do you make a new system that isn't even more regressive if you remove those taxes?
Mr. Hodge.
Those are all very challenging questions, needless to say. I would highly recommend against increasing personal income taxes for the very reason you mentioned, because that's hitting your independent business owners, your S-Corps, your partnerships, LLCs, sole proprietors, and so forth. Those are typically the entrepreneurs of an economy. And so if you're going to hit them with higher progressive tax rates, you are essentially telling the entrepreneurs to go somewhere else. And I think eventually you need to harmonize both business taxes on the corporate side and on the non-corporate side. Eventually, you have to lower both rates. You don't want people, and I have a slide later on, we'll get into more detail on this. But you should treat corporate entities and non-corporate entities the same. You should tax them at the same rate. You don't want people to have to pick and choose. On the other hand, you want to keep both of those rates as low as possible. From a purely economic perspective, income taxes are far more harmful for economic growth than our consumption taxes. And this becomes the trade-off between progressivity or regressivity and economic growth. And at some point, you have to kind of pick and choose. And if you decide to go all the one way and become a purely progressive system, then you end up like New Jersey. You end up completely, you know, an economic shell and stalled, and seeing a great deal of flight out of the state, and then having to backtrack from that. Or you can move toward the Nevada model. Of course, they don't have a personal or corporate income tax, relying solely on sales tax and, of course, gambling. And of course, you know, they have their issues as well. These are all balanced. This, you know, there are trade-offs in life, and there are more trade-offs in tax policy. But from an economic perspective, and I'll get in more detail on this, but economics is telling us that in a world in which capital is extremely mobile, high taxes on corporate and personal income are the most damaging to an economy, far more damaging than consumption taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just as a follow-up, in your last statement, I agree. I think federally the corporate tax is actually progressive, but for states it's very regressive and it does pass through. And so states, I think, probably shouldn't be in the business of the corporate tax. I think that's best left to Congress to determine how they want to work with other nations on that and their competitive index. But, you know, I still am trying to get at, though, not, you know, how do you raise taxes and if they should be progressive or not. I'm not really asking that. I'm saying if we're going to try to compete with nine states that don't have the income tax and we were to take, you know, 40% of our revenue stream away, not even to grow one new dollar, just for the exact same amount of spending, or even less, even cut government, what do you shift to then without it becoming just consumption? Because, you know, we hear a lot that it's just, you know, the high income earners who are job creators, and we all, you know, I think know that really in this committee that that's not true. I mean, people who purchase things are job creators because they take their discretionary income and they go buy things, and that keeps those businesses flowing. So we're all kind of job creators. We're all part of the economy. You know, how could any state get rid of these taxes that now has them and replace even half of the revenue stream, even half, let's say? You know, because we don't have minerals. You know, we're not Texas and we're not Alaska. We don't have pipelines that, you know.
Okay. Yeah. What the hell are you talking about?
Point of order.
Well, different minerals. But, you know, we don't, you know, when you look at this nine states that don't have the income tax, they're kind of uniquely situated.
I just lost control there for a second.
And they do have a lot of ways to return that revenue stream that they can displace on other parts of the nation. And really, Minnesota is not able to do that. So other than the Iron Range, and we'll hear about the mineral rights there, you know, do you have a thought, even in a cutting environment, not raising, how can you actually do this? Because I think Minnesota does have to think about how it's going to compete.
Mr. Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Every state obviously has its advantages and its disadvantages, and many states are using tax policy as an advantage. And in the same way that Maryland uses the deepwater port of Baltimore, or Louisiana has the deepwater ports there. So you have to kind of look at what are going to be your advantages, but how do we minimize the things that are going to be real disadvantages? And while it may be fiscally impossible to eliminate all of your income taxes and move completely to a consumption base, that is probably impractical fiscally for Minnesota to do. You can at least go a long way toward minimizing the penalizing effects of your personal and corporate income taxes as much as possible. Take, as I suggest in my testimony, the Utah-Colorado approach. Harmonize both your corporate and personal income taxes, lower both of those rates as far as you possibly can, get on the other side of the Laffer curve, so to speak. You are on the wrong side of the Laffer curve on both of those, meaning, you know, for Laffer curve, you don't know, there are two ways you can raise zero amount of tax, zero rate and 100%, and then somewhere in between is the maximizing level, and you guys are on the wrong side of the maximizing level on both of them. So bring both of those rates down as far as possible. Accept the fact that you are never going to compete fully with Nevada, or even South Dakota to some degree, or Florida. You'll never have 360 days worth of sun here. People may not come here for the beaches, but you can at least take advantage of what you have and minimize the harmful effects of those things that can chase people away. That would be my recommendation. And to the extent you could broaden the sales tax base, that is far too narrow at this point. You can make up those differences. And we can get into the talk of the regressivity aspect of it. I admit that is a challenge. But there are a lot of things within the personal income tax code that are offering great subsidies to low-income people and greatly offsetting any of the regressive effects of things like sales tax.
Representative Lincheski. At some point here, what we'll do is we'll let, we've got three more people who want to ask some questions. We'll let Mr. Hodge finish his presentation. I want to make sure that he gets all the slides in here. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps this is to our staff as much as to Mr. Hodge, and that is I've always understood that while our marginal top rate is high when you compare, that when you actually look at what corporations actually pay, we're in the middle of the pack. We're average, you know, slightly above, slightly below, depending on whose calculations you look at. And so I think it would be useful for us to see those kind of comparisons as well as, you know, yours data here on the top rate, because I think we do have to weigh whether this is how we compete. But I think the people who I've known who have been involved in corporate decisions about where to locate the next plant elsewhere in the globe, not we can't be kind of an island perspective, have taken into account actually pretty sophisticated analysis that doesn't just look at the top at the marginal top rate, but does really look at their own unique circumstances as well as the labor pool, closeness to of product to the market demand, those sorts of things. And I think if we have any information about that, that would be useful as well. But I do think it was interesting that you said you thought the R&D credit was one that you would factor in if you could create a new model to kind of look at competitiveness of states, but you chose not to include others. And we just passed an R&D expansion last year. And so I think, you know, we do have to weigh to what degree we want to be responsive to with our adjustments to that base. And I think it's been a conscious strategy to have a narrow base and maybe a higher amount, but to incent the kind of businesses that we want to attract. So, you know, if you could, if you get some data or if our staff has some data about how we really do compare when you adjust for it all, I think that would be useful, as well as pros and cons of the different adjustments that we in other states use.
Mr. Hodge?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, we're in the process of building a model which will look at the actual tax burden of a model company in every state, and that'll give us a more apples comparison. But let's not forget, effective rates differ for every type of business. And it depends upon what businesses you want to attract into the state. If you start manipulating the tax code and accepting the fact, well, we're going to have a high rate today, but we're going to offer lots of incentives to different kind of people to bring them in the door, the Neiman Marcus approach. We're going to have a sale on housewares today and furniture tomorrow and so forth, because we're going to bring in different types of businesses. Or you could take the Walmart approach and then have everyday low prices, and then more business comes in broadly. And it sounds like a silly analogy, but it actually is what we're seeing globally as well. And more importantly, and we'll just skip on here.
Representative Lothar, do you have a follow-up? Or?
No, although I must say, I think you have to look at the supplying companies to both Walmart and Neiman Marcus, and they might differ in terms of how much their suppliers spur local and national economies as well.
But Mr. Hodge?
I apologize. But my point was that the effective tax rates will differ markedly based on the type of business. And right now, the businesses that are the drivers of economic growth, the most dynamic companies in economies, not just in the United States but globally, are ones in which are most affected by the top marginal rate, because they don't have a lot of deductions. They don't have the normal or the big depreciation schedules and so forth. And so they're the ones that are most affected by the sticker price. And here we see in this slide the U.S. federal or the U.S. overall corporate tax rate relative to our global trading partners. And it's really important to remind state legislators that they're not taxing businesses in a vacuum. They're levying state-level taxes on top of a federal system. The United States has the highest federally imposed corporate tax of any industrialized country. So your state rates are being placed on top of the highest federally imposed tax anywhere. Localized taxes, then we equalize those across countries, and we find out that Japan has a slightly higher overall statutory rate than does the United States, because their subnational tax rates are also pretty high. But the U.S. has the second highest overall corporate tax rate in the industrialized world, and has for well over two decades. And over the last two decades, we've seen virtually every country on Earth cut their corporate tax rates to be more competitive. In the last 4 years, 60 countries have cut their corporate tax rates.
Representative Lesh?
I just had a brief question about that, Mr. Chair. It was in 2008, right before George Bush left office, that the GAO did a study indicating that corporations don't pay federal corporate taxes, essentially. Very, very few, because they find write-offs everywhere. So maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but the highest imposed tax rate in the industrialized world that nobody pays. Am I misunderstanding what you're talking about?
Yeah, the GAO report has been well cited, and the majority of companies that were cited in that, like General Motors, avoided paying taxes by avoiding having income that year. You kind of have to look at it in context, and just simply what they pay. There are a lot of different factors that go into it. There's federal depreciation. There's bonus depreciation. The economy plays into it. There's a lot of factors that play into it. The overall statutory rate matters, and I'll get into some studies that show that it matters a great deal.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was cute and great, but the fact remains that I don't think a lot of those companies just closed up shop and went away because they didn't have any income. You find ways to do these write-offs. So
they had net operating losses.
Mr. Hodge?
Okay, and so this is not a rhetorical question. I'm seriously wondering about this, of how that matters, because it wasn't just specifically looking at that 1 year. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, please proceed, Mr. Hodge.
Certainly. Companies can become very adept at lowering their tax costs in the same way that they become very adept at lowering other input costs. They move to China, or they move to Malaysia or India to lower their labor costs. They shift patents to lower tax countries in order to avoid the high corporate rate. And so they are able to go through great machinations and gymnastics in order to do so. And you can say, well, you know, they didn't pay the U.S. rate. Well, the U.S. rate forced them to do all of these gymnastics and inefficient business decisions in order to avoid it, in the same way that they move operations to India to lower their labor costs. The bottom line is that the U.S. is way out of step with the rest of the globe. And Japan is about to cut their corporate tax rate, which will leave us with the indignity of having the highest corporate tax rate of all industrialized countries as of about April 1st. And we will stand out. Here's Minnesota's rate, combined federal and state rate, at a little over 41%, which is well higher than the national average, but also higher than the Japan, Canada, China, and the OECD average by a great deal. This ought to be worrisome, not just because how far out of step you are with the OECD or China, but how out of step Minnesota is with Canada. Canada just lowered its federal rate from 18% to 16.5%. Next year, the federal rate's going down to 15%. When you add on the provincial rates, Canada has, as you can see here today, a 28% corporate tax rate. Next year, it'll be even lower. If taxes were the only decision that a business owner in Minnesota had to make, they would easily move to Canada and be instantly more competitive and reduce their cost of doing business. For multinationals, it's even more advantageous because Canada has for all intents and purposes, a territorial tax system, whereas the U.S. has a worldwide tax system. And so they would greatly reduce their tax costs by moving to Canada. Question.
Representative Wardwell.
Just a quick question. With regard to China, how are you calculating that corporate tax rate? Does that apply to state-owned enterprises in China? Does that apply to across the board?
Yeah, this is their new corporate tax rate They used to have a differential rates between domestic and foreign-owned companies, but they have changed that now, and they've moved to this low standardized rate for all companies, foreign and domestic. So this is the new rate in China.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So China has apparently seen the wisdom of eliminating certain exclusions and differentiations between different parts of its economy.
Mr. Hodge.
By and large, I wouldn't say that China is free from using various incentives and abatements and all kinds of when you go to China, you have to negotiate. But this is what the list price is.
But that's the direction they're moving.
You know, we've long debated in economics sort of who bears the true economic burden of corporate taxes, and we were talking about this earlier, that economists have traditionally seen the true economic burden of corporate taxes fall on three parties. Falls on consumers through higher prices, workers through lower wages, or shareholders or investors through lower returns. And so the question has been, well, who bears the biggest burden? And a lot of it depends. But in what we're finding today, especially in a global economy where capital is very, very mobile, but workers aren't, that the burden of corporate taxes falls on the least mobile factor in the economy. And workers really, really are now bearing that burden as much as between 45% and 75%. I think I've skipped ahead of a. All right, we'll go back. We'll go here. So anyway, the true economic burden of corporate taxes is falling on workers. So if we care about workers and increasing their wages and productivity. We should lower the corporate tax rate. And in fact, a Tax Foundation study last year looked at over a 30-year period of time the relationship between state corporate taxes and wages across the 50 states. And we found that for every dollar that states raised their corporate taxes, wages fell over time by $2.50. Of course, the flip side of that is also true. As corporate taxes fall, wages will rise, and that's because those lower corporate taxes translate into more productivity and then eventually into higher wages for workers. Other studies.
Excuse me, we have another question. Representative
sure.
Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more, I'm not sure if this would be part of the study or not, but you have personal income tax, consumption tax, corporate tax, property tax. Is there any studies looking, you know, in parts of Europe? And I know China has been taking on carbon as well as a big issue, but as any looking at carbon tax and how that would relate to any of these taxes.
Mr. Hodge?
Well, carbon taxes sort of are outside of the you know, this particular framework. And actually, I did skip a slide, and I apologize. We were looking at what are the most harmful taxes. A carbon tax will change economic behavior. That's what it's intended to do if it's raised high enough. It will move people out of carbon-intensive activities into others. But because it's a consumption tax, it's generally thought of as being less economically harmful than would a corporate or personal income tax. And getting back to the slide here.
Representative Knuth. Excuse me, Representative Knuth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chai. It's just so because it's generally a consumption tax in terms of growth, say lowering a corporate income or a corporate tax and raising some of that with it, a carbon tax would be better for business potentially in an economy or for business growth.
Mr. Hodge?
Well, I have to give that some thought. The carbon tax is generally ends up being levied on the consumer, not the business. And so if you were to, for instance, and this is what the OECD may recommend, replacing the corporate income tax with a carbon tax. If that were the trade-off, then you would see more positive effects from that than if you just levied a carbon tax on itself. If you just levied a carbon tax, it would have harmful economic effects. It would clearly depress the economy because it's intended to reduce consumption. But if you offset those effects with something like reducing the corporate tax, which is much more harmful, then on net, that will be better off for the economy. Does that make, am I getting that?
Representative Knuth.
And that's generally what the OECD, and which is worldwide body looking at what makes economic growth, found in their studies. The corporate income tax is the most harmful tax for long-term economic growth, followed by high personal taxes, and then followed by consumption and property taxes. And so what they recommend is that nations, and in our case states, move away from these high income-based taxes toward consumption-based taxes. The OECD is pretty fond of value-added taxes. I'm not. Or consumption, or like a carbon tax.
Okay, please proceed.
If you were to trade off one for the other, that's what you should do.
Please proceed.
So anyway, this slide ought to be kept in mind. And then next, about the relationship between corporate taxes and wages. It is now becoming pretty evident that workers are bearing the burden of corporate taxes through lower wages, and particularly in some cases unionized workers who tend to bear it more than others. And getting to this point of the regressivity issue, which was, I thought, very insightful, corporate taxes are, because they are largely can be passed down through higher prices, can be regressive as well. In fact, your own Department of Revenue produces a marvelous tax incidence study every year. I encourage everyone to read it. And it finds that, in this case, because the corporate tax is passed through in higher prices, that it disproportionately burdens low-income people more than the personal income tax. Obviously, a lot of them get rebates through the personal income tax. But here, what we can see for the lowest deciles, those earning up to about $26,000 a year, the corporate income tax, or the effective corporate tax in red, is higher than it is for the personal income tax. So by reducing the corporate tax, you would actually benefit them disproportionately than high-income people, where the corporate tax is not much of a burden. And then the caveat, we have been focusing on the corporate tax, getting back to this issue that we have two types of business entities in the United States, not just corporate, but we do have this really healthy and dynamic non-corporate sector. The majority of corporations in America today are actually S-corporations. In fact, there are more S-corps than there are traditional C-corps. There is actually more business income taxed under the federal individual income tax code than there is under the traditional corporate code. And that is because we have about 27 million individual businesses, either sole proprietors, S-corps, partnerships, and LLCs. And they file their business taxes on their individual tax return. So we don't want to have any sort of a great differential between corporate and individual income taxes. Minnesota has a 2 percentage point differential, which probably doesn't make a big difference, but you want to minimize it. At the federal level, for the first time in the history of the tax code, the top personal rate and the top corporate rate are the same, and we want to keep that and maintain that. And that's why I would recommend moving towards sort of this Colorado-Utah model, which has the same rate for both individuals and corporations. And that way you minimize those differentials. Another caveat, I know that for fiscal reasons, it's very attractive to want to phase in tax reforms. Listen, this happens we see this in a lot of states, and it's very understandable. The problem is that you can actually do more harm than good because of it, or you don't see the benefits that you want out of the tax reform because you can almost paralyze the economy. Now, these particular studies that I'm citing here, we're looking at the federal tax phase-ins, but what they found, I thought, is pretty relevant here, and we see this in states, and that these phased-in tax cuts can stall economic decision-making and economic activity, leading to actually job losses and lower investment in GDP. And so you want to get to the tax reform as fast as possible. And that's the subject of my next slide. Then how are you going to do it? Well, I don't think that you can work within the corporate tax code, for instance, through base broadening to lower the rate enough. In fact, actually, Minnesota has a pretty clean corporate code, I think. And so I would look outside of the system and look at broadening the sales tax base. And as I read the Revenue Department's tax expenditure report, there seems to be a lot of room within the sales tax to broaden, to raise sufficient enough revenues to offset a reduction in the corporate rate. I am not politically naive. I understand the optics of this, that lowering taxes on big business and raising granny's taxes on groceries is not politically popular. Would not come off well. However, if we get back to the issue of trading off harmful taxes for less harmful taxes, we have to argue that we're trying to grow the economy, we're trying to raise wages, and these are taxes that have a less effect. On the other side, we know that the corporate tax is regressive, so in some respects you're replacing a transparent regressive tax with a hidden a tax. And so that's really it. The bottom line is that Minnesota's tax system is greatly out of step regionally, nationally, and globally. It has one of the highest overall tax burdens in the nation, one of the poorest tax climates for business in the nation, and that by either eliminating or phasing down or lowering the corporate tax would greatly improve the state's economy, leading to I think, higher wages and living standards for all Minnesotans. And that ought to be a goal I think everyone can agree to. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hodge. We'll open up for some questions. I've got a couple here. Did you say in your closing remarks phasing out the corporate income tax?
I know that that was one of the proposals that's been considered, and I mentioned that, even though I would recommend cutting it first rather than phasing it out.
Okay.
My apologies.
Okay. Now, would it be safe to say that if we did go to a broader base on the sales tax and spread it out, maybe even lower the rate a bit, that would be a much more stable income source to the state than the corporate income tax? So doesn't the corporate income tax, you hope it's there, but maybe it's not?
The corporate income tax, is, as you mentioned, is the most volatile tax of the three-legged stool. And actually, we've done comparisons, which I didn't bring with me here, comparing total tax revenues in Texas versus tax revenues in California. And in California, which has a very highly progressive system, tax revenues tend to be like a roller coaster, whereas in Texas, which relies mainly on sales taxes, the tax base is much more stable and predictable. And so, yes, you would have a much more predictable, much more stable tax base by moving toward that lower rate, broader sales tax base.
Okay, thank you. We have some questions here from Representative Bills, Marquardt, Runbeck, and Downey, and anyone else that would like to get on the list. So, and we'll go till noon here with questions unless we run out of questions. Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hodge, I was wondering, your organization's been around since 1937.
That's correct.
And just you've seen so many different schools of economic thought. I was wondering your organization's view of behavioral economics, and then if what you base your rationale your opinions on, and if there's any research around, you know, Representative Tilbury's questions about the different variables, deductions, credits, incentives within those structures made me think of that, and I'm wondering if that's on your radar in your organization at all.
Mr. Hodge?
Well, while the Tax Foundation's been around since 1937, I haven't. But all kidding aside, we have seen a lot of changes in economic theory over that nearly 75 years. But certainly we're knowing a lot more on how people respond to certain things, and people are not necessarily rational. That's perhaps one of the that's been sort of the standard assumption in economics for decades. And lo and behold, people do lots of irrational things, and so we have to take that into account. But people do respond also to taxes, and we do know to some degree the direction in which they will be incentivized, even if we don't know the amount. And unfortunately, what happens is, in a lot of times when we score tax changes, we tend to think that people won't change. And so we do these static scores, and we need to take into account far more the behavioral changes that we'll see. It's very difficult. But what we do know, for instance, if you lower taxes, in some cases, you'll see more economic activity, and that will increase economic growth and will increase tax revenues. Not to say that tax cuts pay for themselves all the time, but we will see more economic activity. And on the flip side, you can disincentivize activity as well.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Just a couple more. Mr. Hodge, do expectations on debt service and debt burden then play in as you look at, you know, almost a Fisher equation in that respect, you know, the theory of rational expectations of a firm in terms of future tax burden?
Thank you. Mr. Hodge?
Certainly economists do. I don't know if taxpayers do. And investors may. So those who are buying your bonds will look forward and say, oh, my God, you know, you guys are in for a world of trouble because you're going to have to raise taxes to pay them back. It's, I think, still an open question whether everyday taxpayers will look at that. On the other hand, that's at the state level. On the federal level, people are looking at these $1.5 trillion deficits, and I think they are factoring in, someday I'm going to have to pay higher taxes. They can't do the equation in their head, but intuitively they understand. So, you know, it may be a general sense. I don't think it's as neat and tidy as a lot of economists would want to believe, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more. Is there any data that you're aware of that couples what's in your tax studies with any worker productivity rates around the globe? Thank you.
Well, I haven't. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, which is it was the relic of the Marshall Plan. And so anyway, their job is to look at what causes economic growth or what are the systems that most help economic growth and then help OECD nations get there. Their fabulous couple of studies, one, Tax Policy Reform and Economic Growth, came out in November, does look at that very question. And in particular, you know, they are looking at the effects of different types of taxes, not only on the economy in general, but more specifically on productivity and the kinds of things that generate economic growth. And those, and they do tie together lower corporate taxes, more productivity, higher economic growth. And so that's the sequence in which they put it together. We haven't ourselves looked at it, but others have, and it's a pretty clear sequence.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hodge. I appreciate your testimony. I think the thing to remember, and I think you would admit to this, that when we're talking about business climate, you're really just talking about one area that would be involved in business climate, and that's mm-hmm. taxes.
Right.
And, you know, it's a narrow approach. I mean, it would be like trying to predict who's going to win the Super Bowl game this week by just looking at each team's offensive lines. You know, it's a part of it, but, you know, and I hope members, as you listen to this, don't go to a knee-jerk reaction that we need to cut taxes right away. It might be part of the mix. But, you know, Minnesota, for example, has the second highest percent of high school graduates and 11th highest in bachelor's degrees and 20th in the nation in those who graduate with engineering and science degrees. And I think Minnesota's in the top 10 in both gas, lowest in gas and electrical utility rates. And, you know, 15th in per capita income. So there's a number of things that I think a business would look at that would lend itself to a business climate. And, you know, if we, let's say we were to eliminate the corporate income tax, maybe $1 billion a year. Okay, let's say we have $1 billion to work with. $1 billion to work with. Would we all put it into tax relief, or would we look at more investments in workforce development or education or infrastructure or whatever that might be? And I think that's kind of what I want members to look at. And one thing that bothers me a little bit about the business climate is, and granted you're looking at taxes, but the focus only on the tax rate. And I think some of our members, like Representative Tilbury, was getting to that. To just focus on the tax rate when we know what tax expenditures, the effective tax rates are much different. Mr. Chair, one of my favorite players of all time was Lou Brock of the St. Louis Cardinals. And he used to have more errors than most outfielders. And if you looked at just that errors that he made, you would have thought he was not a very good outfielder. However, he was so fast. Remember, he used to steal a lot of bases. He would get to balls most fielders never would, and he'd hit it on the glove, and they'd count it an error. And yet he was making way more catches than the average outfielder. So, you know, just to look at tax rate, I don't think would be only indicator. And I don't know if you've seen this report, and it's a good one if you haven't. It's Ernst & Young, and they put it out. It's on March 2010. And it's in conjunction with the Council on State Taxation, which is an advisory arm of the Chamber of Commerce. And one of the authors is Robert Klein, who had the tax research position here in the state of Minnesota, the very same position that Dr. Paul Wilson has now. He had it prior. And one area is really interesting, looking at effective tax rates. And they say that this really is a good starting point for looking at comparing to other states on what percent of taxes that businesses pay as percent of private sector gross product. And they said you also have to look, this isn't the only thing, you have to look at, you know, where is the sales ratio? Is it lot and property or sales or whatever? And actually, we would be on the good end of that, actually, because we're moving to the 100% sales. They said if it's property or payroll, like they said, Indiana might rank good on this, but actually it wouldn't be as good because they have 70% in sales of property. So actually, we probably would be better off on this. And I think it's interesting to note on this that Minnesota, our effective tax rate is 4.3 cents on every dollar of private sector gross state product. The statewide average is 4.7. We're the 16th lowest. And of all the border cities around us, we are the lowest. And so that's the problem I have with just looking at a tax rate, is that I think business, if they're really looking at locating to a specific place, is going to look at effective tax rates and is going to dig in a lot deeper than just looking at a tax rate. And, you know, some of the statistics earlier there, and I waited to the end because I had more comments and questions, Mr. Chair.
That's fine, but before you proceed, the 68 Cardinals, who else played with Lou Brock? Your name?
Kurt Flood was in center field. Roger Maris in right field. Orlando Cepeda was at first. Julian Javier at second. Al Maxwell at shortstop. Mike Shannon at third base. Catcher was Tim McCarver.
And who's your best pitcher?
Well, Gibson, who struck out 35 that series. Okay.
Please proceed. I can do the 69 Cubs, too. That was impressive.
Yeah. Well, I followed those Cardinals. You know, they lost in 68. They lost to the Tigers, and they were up 3-1 and got beat. Even hitting Minnesota. Yes. But you did. You mentioned something about the increase in population. Minnesota increased 7.8%, which, other than South Dakota, which was 7.9, was the highest of all of the states around it. And it seems like you make some inferences that if you're high tax, you're slow growth, so to speak. And that wouldn't, you know, because higher than North Dakota in other areas.
As a whole grew at 10%.
Mr. Hodge.
So you were below the national rate.
That's correct.
Let me address the cost study when you get a chance.
Okay, you bet. I think sometimes you hear all these states say lost population. Well, only one state ever lost population. That was Michigan. Yep. What you're, I think, trying to say is that they were below the average, which is 10%, or 9.7%.
Michigan lost.
Right, that's what I'm saying. One state lost. Michigan actually lost. Yeah. But one of the terms you used early on was Minnesota's shrinking population, and we're not shrinking. We gained over 300,000. And
Representative Marquardt, I think you said shrinking taxpayer population.
It might. And just one other thing, too. We're on a chart where you mentioned the loss of revenue by income. And from calendar year, this is the Price of Government report, November 2010, that, and maybe you're using different numbers, and I guess I'd like to ask you that. But in calendar year 01, the Minnesota personal income was $166 billion, and in calendar year 2009, it was $220 billion, which is an increase of $54 billion or 33%. Pretty significant increase. And so, I mean, I guess my bottom line here is that I think there's, and I think you would agree, we're just focusing on taxes here. But as we look at trying to, you know, if we want to create jobs and retain jobs and so forth, there are many, many factors. And I think looking at just the tax rate just simply is too simplistic and doesn't really get into what might be the overall tax structure of this state. And then the last comment I want to make is I heard several times a few folks saying that people who don't pay taxes, and I know you clarified that, but not some members, where I think you're talking just income tax returns.
Sure.
I think everyone pays sales taxes, they pay fees, they probably pay property taxes, even if they're not paying income taxes.
Excuse me, Representative Markert, you have the floor.
So, anyway, the one question I would have as we kind of talk about the overall business climate is if you had $1 billion to spend, I mean, let's say we were to eliminate the, would you spend it all in tax relief, or would you look at also other infrastructure things like education and workforce development and so forth? So,
it's like the Steve Martin. How to become a millionaire. Well, first you get $1 million. First we get $1 billion, and what are we going to do with it? Well, you mentioned that Minnesota has this exceptionally high graduation rate for high school students. That's wonderful. Absolutely. Hope you can keep it up. How many of those people are staying in the state? How many of those people have jobs once they get out of high school or college or what have you? It could be, like California, you're educating a lot of other people's workforces if they don't stay in the state. Education, investing in education is wonderful. But number one, you don't know if you've done any good for about 18 years. And unless you have a good place for people to work, you've just simply trained someone else's workforce. Would I put it in roads, infrastructure? Well, as one economist said of the wonderful roads in West Virginia, it just allows people to flee the state even faster. So you can change your tax climate today and see instant impacts tomorrow. And so were I to rank order these things, yeah, I put it in taxes right now because taxes really matter, and they matter the most. On the cost study is a very interesting study, but in this case not all that useful, I'm afraid. It's simply a collection. It's not a tax burden study, and it's actually mispromoted that way, and I've had my disagreements with them on that, even though I have many friends over there at cost. It simply is looking at the collections. Businesses are collection agents for the government, right? They collect sales taxes. They collect personal income taxes. They collect, you know, all of those things, property taxes, and then they remit them to government. That's not a burden. The burden is really what the end person pays, and we saw that with this. This is the burden. And the burden of corporate taxes falls, in some cases, heavily on low-income people. And that is simply a collection measure. And there are a lot of reasons that businesses may not, in Minnesota, may not collect as much for the state treasury as other states. But it doesn't mean what they're really burdened by or what is actually being affected on taxpayers. So anyway, that's my soapbox on that point. But taxes, are they everything? No. Are high education rates important? Yes. Are good transportation systems important? Yes. There are lots of factors that go into a business climate. But taxes are becoming more and more important every day and every year. And we see this globally. Otherwise, 60 nations would not have cut their corporate taxes over the last 4 years. You wouldn't see the kinds of changes on especially corporate tax policy that we have seen in the last decade were it not for that fact that taxes do matter. I leave it to the objective economists at the OECD that the most harmful taxes are corporate and personal income, and that's because capital and income are the most sensitive factors in the economy to high tax rates and can have a dramatic effect on long-term economic growth. So
It's not me saying it. It's, you know, it's others.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hodge, let's suppose that this, you know, sort of bad tax climate in Minnesota is having an impact over time. And or let's say it's not. What are the best measures of what's happening trend-wise in Minnesota? And I would have to think it would be our GDP, our state GDP. I never hear anyone here talk about it. And, you know, isn't that a key number in assessing how our economy is growing or slowing in Minnesota? But what other factors might there be?
Mr. Hodge.
I think economic growth is one of the key factors that you should really be looking at. And you can see it in different ways. The fact that the state is facing some budget troubles is probably an indicator. Obviously the entire United States is having an economic downturn, and all the levels of government are facing some economic or fiscal challenges, but some states are facing them more, and your economics can play a large portion in that. And so, you know, states that have grown the most, or at least held their own during this time, are doing better fiscally than states that haven't. And going forward, economic growth is really one key to solving your fiscal problems. Obviously, restraining spending is another one. But having a healthy climate and business climate and a healthy economy will reduce the number of people who need public services and increase the demands on government, but also while increasing revenues.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hodge, I believe Minnesota's GSB or GDP is about $225 billion. Is that really the single best measure then of really seeing how rapidly or how slowly we're growing?
Mr. Hodge.
Well, GDP and economic growth are have to be among the top three ways in which you look at the overall performance of the state. I mean, you want to look at incomes. Incomes are terribly important as well, personal income.
Okay.
But that has to be, that's one of the top line measures of, it's sort of like profits for a company. It's one of the top line measures of the success of a state.
Mm-hmm. Chair Runbeck.
Well, that's really all I have. Thank you.
Representative Downey, Rukovina, Loon, Lesh. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great discussion here, and as we think about kind of comparative advantage at large in Minnesota with so many things being kind of nationalized and federalized, I think tax policy has got to be in the mix, and I'm glad we're having the discussion. Question for Mr. Hodge. When we think about the sales tax and rotating from income-based taxes to sales taxes, we have this challenge of regressivity. And I'm wondering, beyond just kind of lower income credits and exemptions, are there other strategies in the way you structure the sales tax to get at that question of fairness and regressivity?
We often hear this in terms of the grocery tax in particular, and a number of states either struggle with trying to add groceries back into the sales base, or some states are choosing or looking to remove it from the sales tax base. And the frequent argument is it's regressive. You know, low-income people, that's the majority of their spending, etc. But for people who are truly at the low end are recipients of federal food stamps. And to a large degree, that mitigates, you know, any of the impact of a state sales tax through the use of food stamps. Most low-income people are the recipients of rather generous federal tax rebates, refundable tax credits, either through the earned income tax credit or the child credit. In fact, for a family of four earning up to about $40,000 a year, $42,000. Will have no income tax, federal income tax liability at all, and most of those people will get some form of a generous tax rebate. And so those rebates can have a great impact on mitigating the impact of some of these other regressive taxes. In fact, that's why they were put into the code, in large measure to offset the payroll tax, but in some cases these people are getting money in excess of whatever they pay in payroll taxes as well. And so when you look at the overall fiscal situation of that family, their tax burden, if you add up everything, is actually still below zero. They have a negative effective tax rate because of the generosity of these credits and deductions that not only eliminate their income tax burden, but then subsidize or offset all of the other taxes that they end up paying.
Senator Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow on to that, then, if we look ahead 20 years, and I think we'd be wise not to target our any changes or reforms we'd make in tax structure in Minnesota to reality today, but to try and be a little predictive and proactive and think about the world 10 to 20 years from now. And I know we have a kind of an ongoing question struggle about how to capture sales tax on internet sales, and those kinds of things will only increase. And so I'm wondering if as you think ahead, ultimately long term, if you kind of over leverage yourself towards the sales tax, do we end up in a similar competitive disadvantage 20 years from now when the lowest sales tax rate is going to be the thing that actually attracts the most revenue and opportunity to your state? So anyway, just looking ahead, and I know it's a crystal ball, but the impact of the internet and kind of globalization, do we have any risks that we should be thinking about if we were to actually move over to a consumption-based tax strategy based on where the world is and where commerce is heading?
Mr. Hodge?
Well, certainly tax law is bumping up against Moore's Law. And we have old tax systems that are trying to tax a new economy. And in many respects, taxing the Internet's taxing a fugitive resource. It's like taxing fish in the ocean. They move through, you know, jurisdictions. And it's virtually impossible. Yes, it's clearly possible that at some point, you could see more bleed off that way. But by and large, you know, you're still going to have, you know, a sales tax base. You won't see everyone shopping for groceries on the internet, but it's certainly a challenge. And but you know, we still sort of have the economics here that, you know, taxing income is going to be, that's the real fugitive resource right now, is capital. And so we want to minimize taxes on things that are the most mobile factors, the things that are hardest to capture. And so we end up taxing the things that are least mobile, and that's workers and property. And eventually, that's kind of what you're stuck with. The tax world is yet to catch up with where the economy is going, and I don't have any perfect answer there. But these are the challenges that all legislators are going to be facing, and it's going to be increasingly difficult.
Representative Downey?
Final follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hodge, so we have all these challenges with these existing components of taxation, and I'm wondering if there are new ideas, new forms. Representative Knuth mentioned taxing carbon, and so this concept of taxing negative behaviors as compared to positive ones, such as economic activity. Mm-hmm. Any ideas? I hear terms like fair tax and other things, per capita kinds of. Are there any new models or new forms that are emerging that it might be wise for us to at least take a look at?
Mr. Hodge?
At the state level, I would highly recommend against moving toward a carbon tax. That is something that should be done at a national level and not at a state level. That would make you uncompetitive instantly. That is something that has to be done at a national level and can't be done on a state level. And many of these kinds of taxes on externalities, as we call them in economics, or harmful behaviors, tend to have to be done at a national level. And doing them at the state level, in some cases, can have an effect, but you have to be careful. A lot of legislators want to reduce teen smoking or teen drinking, and so they raise beer taxes. Well, guess who can cross over the border and buy a cheaper six-pack of beer? And then that has a cascading effect as people start border shopping because you have large tax differentials. I don't have any new models. I don't know if there are any new models out there, and although we are seeing people try to experiment, but it's a very challenging environment for legislators these days and the tax world in general.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have several more questions here, and then I don't know when your flight takes off or if they've all been canceled because of the weather in Chicago or something.
I have time. I appreciate it. I'm leaving tomorrow. So.
Okay. Keep asking questions till tomorrow. we will be shutting down at noon, but would you be willing to come up to my office in the corner up there, and any members that don't get to ask questions could ask them then?
Yes. I think I have like a 1:30 or 2 o'clock meeting, so I do have some flexibility.
Okay. And if not, that's fine too. But okay, Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hodge, let me just preface everything I'm going to say by telling you I'm the dumbest guy in the room here, so I haven't followed half of what you said nor agreed with it. But in any event, my first question to you is this. Minnesota has a very high proportion of Fortune 500 companies as opposed to our population. How do we get there if we're so bad?
Asked and answered. Mr. Hodge.
Well, companies can grow and become Fortune 500. It's where they're expanding. Are they expanding in state or are they expanding elsewhere? Target just announced it's expanding in Canada. As I explained, Canada has exceptionally low corporate taxes. Well, and so we're going to see the big expansion of these companies is outside the state. And so while the state may enjoy a few hundred corporate executives here, they're not really enjoying the broader prosperity of the company as it grows elsewhere and seeks opportunities elsewhere.
I think my answer would be that there are a lot of other factors besides taxes. But be that as it may. Next question, since you mentioned Canada. You know, Canada has a 28% corporate tax rate. Does that take into account their socialized medical system? Because I know, being from northern Minnesota, where we mine 90% of the domestic iron ore,
so you do have minerals?
Yeah, we do.
The state?
Representative Lynchesky didn't realize that. Anyway, and some of the richest deposits of non-ferrous mining minerals in the world, I might add, but that's a whole other issue. But anyway, does that include their socialized medicine tax? Because I know our tax, local property tax, the way we figure, we call it a production tax on ore, is $2.39 a ton. And from what I've told, it's over $3 a ton for their medical costs, whereas in Canada, their ore corporations, their mining corporations, have no tax of that nature or no pay none of that. So is that included in your 28%
Mr. Hodge?
28% is purely the corporate income tax.
So you're comparing apples to oranges. And finally, last question. Since China is doing so successful, is the Tax Foundation advocating we adopt their form of government?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
that. Yeah, you're sorry. I got to go.
I just didn't hear.
Should we become communists like China so we can be successful? They seem to be teaching the world about capitalism. You know, this corporate, is there any transparency in these numbers from a communist government that it's their corporate tax is 25%? Because my understanding is the government and the army are skimming constantly over there, and who knows what their real numbers are. Where's the transparency in? And I'm just wondering if the Tax Foundation is advocating that we adopt their form of government.
Mr. Hodge?
I don't know how you answer that, Mr.
Chairman. I don't think you do. Okay. Thank you. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, you're a hard act to follow. My question actually was largely covered by Representative Downey with regards to the sales tax and you know, managing kind of the regressive effects of that. But a couple of follow-up on that. Any states that have, within the last, you know, 10 to 20 years, started moving more towards a consumptions tax versus income tax or corporate taxes, and what you're able to glean from the behavior of consumers in those states, and if the any negative effects on certain types of industries, mm-hmm. Or goods and services sold in those states. And then the other question I had, you sort of argued strongly against a phase-in of a reduction of corporate tax and just kind of making the whack and that because of the behavioral effects of that phase-in. What about a phase-in of a sales tax? Would that have any negative or positive commentations doing it one way versus another?
Mr. Hodge.
We don't have a lot of experience right now with states shifting away from income-based taxes to more consumption-based. Although a few states, such as Ohio, for instance, did actually eliminate their corporate income tax and replace it with a gross receipts-style tax, that's a different type of tax than either a pure sales or a pure income. It's a rather odd hybrid. And we're still waiting to see what that's going to do. I'm not a big fan of gross receipts taxes because they essentially tax businesses irrespective of whether they have profits or not, and they lead to all kinds of their own sorts of problems. They phased it in, and Ohio's performance over that five-year period was not particularly exemplary, so it's hard to tell. We just don't have enough evidence right now or enough experiences with states doing this. And, of course, as you can probably know, over the last couple of years, most states have been increasing various types of taxes to deal with their budgetary problems. And only now can they shift gears and start to think about how do we reposition ourselves and be more competitive. I wish we had more experiences to get to your point. We only have them on a global basis, not on a state basis. And the preponderance of trends globally has been states moving away from income-based taxes to consumption-based. And most of those countries have a value-added tax, which we obviously do not have in the United States. Canada does have that. And so we only have the sales taxes as our comparable. So we right now we can only rely on those global. And then the second part of your question was
Evelyn
on the
The question was about whether any certain types of industries would be more affected by a sales tax, or and then your impressions on a phase in.
Yeah.
Of a sales
tax. Clearly, you know, the retail sector will have the most heartburn on moving or expanding the sales tax, and especially if you have border differentials. If Wisconsin's sales tax rate were dramatically lower, those border counties may see some shifting. Again, there are always trade-offs in tax policy, and what you give up on one, you may lose in another, and this is always the challenge. But in terms of the phase-in of a tax increase, I would say that with something like the sales tax, would be less detrimental than if you were to phase in a tax increase on income. There you would see far more shifting of economic activity than you would on something like sales. People tend not to see the sales tax rate in the same way or respond to it in the same way.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Erickson, and then we'll wrap it up here. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hodge, will you comment on the flat tax? Steve Forbes is always promoting that. What's your take from the Tax Foundation on that?
Mr. Hodge.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The flat tax, I think, is a far, far superior tax to what we have today. It, from all economic theory and the principles in which we advocate, the flat tax is a far, far superior tax and something we should be moving toward, and that is taxing income only once. You tax it as close to where it is generated as possible. You remove as many distortions from the tax system as possible, and then you simply allow people to and the economy to do what it does. And it's an exceptionally efficient tax. Produces very little drag on the economy, and it's from both a taxpayer standpoint and a tax collector standpoint, it's very efficient too. It's easy to comply with, and it's easy to collect, and so it's a win-win, I think, for all parties involved.
Representative Erickson. Okay, with that, the Tax Committee, Mr. Hodge, would like to thank you for your testimony. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.